Blog Talk Radio.
Hey folks, this is Rabble Rouse and Rich Bergeron.
Yo, back from vacation with the tornado Tony Pentecal.
And go figure, while you were on vacation, we got hit by a storm named Rocky.
Man, well, get this. Get this. Guess who got on the local Philadelphia news broadcast on Tuesday night?
You? Were you at the airport trying to get out?
No, even better. I was down seeing the Phillies play your favorite team, the Yankees.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. They had down in Florida that day, they had tornado watches. Now, I was in Clearwater, 15 miles away in Tampa. They showed a quick tornado that hit. You know, one of those, it was literally a two-second tornado. And so they're showing the Philadelphia, I'll send you the video. They're showing the Philadelphia sports broadcast, and they're like, yeah, under tornado watches. Oh, wait, look at this guy. Oh, my God, his name's Tornado. I also have to send you, I don't know if you saw on my Facebook page, I am now considered the ultimate Philadelphia Phillies superfan.
Sweet.
Yeah, they followed me around the park. I was getting free drinks and everything.
Nice. Were you, like, dressed up in costume or something?
Come on, Rich, you know me.
Yeah, geez, all you have to do is wear a hat sometimes, and people seem to pick you out of the crowd.
You're not familiar with what I wear to when I go to Phillies games, are you?
Sort of a Captain America uniform there?
Yeah, the Captain America Uncle Sam Apollo Creed uniform.
Yeah, I've seen those pictures.
Yeah, I'll tell you. You'll have to post the link on the Fight News Unlimited. But yeah, here's one of our top contributors. Oh God, what was I thinking when I brought him on board?
Well, we have a special guest tonight, Dr. Jedediah Jones, and he is the fellow who that's partly responsible for making sure Ishe Smith would be able to get in the ring against his opponent recently there for the IBF Junior Middleweight Championship. Can you remind me of who he fought there? I don't have it right in front of me.
Yeah, he fought Quinn Relief Canine Bondridge.
Exactly. Yeah, there it is. Okay. So, Dr. Jones, not to be confused with the other Dr. Jones from the movies.
Right.
Yeah. But he had a situation where he treated Smith. He had a bad knuckle, and he didn't have to end up doing surgery. And Smith actually said, if it was Dr. Jones's care that nurtured me back to health, if it wasn't for his treatment, I would have never had this opportunity. It was a blessing to be able to take this fight because my knuckle was in pretty bad shape.
I'm saying that after the fight. I did, you know, try to catch as much as I could this weekend. I didn't leave till Sunday, so I was able to, you know, watch Friday and Saturday.
And Dr. Jones is a Las Vegas native, and so is Smith. And I know that, you know, out in Vegas, it's a pretty good place to be a hand surgeon or an orthopedic surgeon, which is what Jones is. Because you got a lot of fighters out there. I was just kind of thinking on the way home tonight from my errands about all the different fighters we've had on the show who have had hand issues. And the top two that come to mind are the coal miner's daughter there, the female fighter. Drawing a blank again. You would know better. Christy Martin. Christy Martin, right. She had a broken hand, and I talked a little bit about that in the interview. And then we had, I know, Pauly Malignaggi. I know we didn't have him on, but he had some hand injuries that were, bothered him in certain fights. We had not really a hand injury, but orthopedic type of injury with Misha Tate in MMA. And we had, of course, John Jones obviously had a situation where he had an injury to his hand that almost prevented him from fighting at one point, but he ended up not going through surgery and seeking an alternative route there, and it hasn't bothered him since. So we'll have to kind of pick Jones's brain about what fighters can do to protect their hands a little better, and you know, some of the things that he can do to avoid surgery like that. We also have Psychic Tom just joining us. How's it going, Tom?
Good evening, gentlemen. Good evening, good evening.
Right. Tom, when do you want an autograph? Well, I'm a big star now, Tom.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, I was telling Rich, when I was down in Florida this week, they showed me on the major Philadelphia news broadcast. Because I was down in Florida at the one baseball game, and in the Tampa area, they had tornado watches all day. So when they showed clips of the game back home, and they were like, yeah, there were tornado watches. But the only guy we see is this guy here, and oh, my God, his name is Tornado.
Okay, all right. We'll have to get an autograph, huh?
Yeah, I'll send you guys the clips tonight.
Oh, cool.
And I've also been anointed as the ultimate Philadelphia Phillies sports fan. They followed me around the whole stadium, watching me get free drinks, and you know, did a whole big profile on me.
You gotta get tickets for that honor, right?
You know what? A friend of mine got me today. You know, I was in my one friend's house. We were working out, then we were hanging out for a while. Then coming home, I get a phone call from a girl, and from the Philadelphia Phillies organization, offering me the chance to work with the mascot for the opening day and help shoot out some of the t-shirts and come down on the field. Well, of course, I jump all over the opportunity. Then they tell me I got to get all these physicals and crazy stuff. And then, you know, I thanked them, gave them my address, gave them my phone number, and, or gave them my email. They had my phone number. And then my one friend called me. I'm like, dude, you'll never believe what's happened to me. And he started laughing. I'm like, oh, you assholes. The girl that was in on the joke, apparently she seems to forget that I'm good friends with Bradley Cooper from the Hangover fame. Now, of course, I'm lying, but he did grow up one town over from me, and he's only a year older than me. So we have her convinced that not only do I know him, but I will be attending the Philadelphia premiere of the Hangover 3 with Bradley Cooper in May. He's begging to go, and I'm like, no, I'm taking, you know, my friend Mike, because he knew Bradley when we were kids, and my friend Steve, because it's his birthday. Well, do you think Steve will step down? I said, no, it's his birthday. Do you think Mike will step down? I said, no, he knows the guy. Well, would you step down? And I'm like, of course not. And I said, by the way, if you played that joke on me, no, I'm definitely not stepping down. But I also had the same girl a couple weeks ago. She said something about Mike Tyson. He was on Facebook, and I'm like, oh, isn't he the guy from The Hangover? She goes, well, yeah, but he's also a boxer. I'm like, oh, I said, boxing? I don't know much about boxing. She goes, it's a sport where they wear like shorts and gloves and they punch each other. I said, I know what it is. I know what boxing is. I just don't follow the sport. I don't know anything about the sport. And she goes, oh, I really don't like it either. And my friend Steph says, you know, he is a former boxer, and he covers boxing for a website, and he trains people for boxing, and then she felt kind of really stupid.
Well, speaking of superstars, a funny story came out today. Ronda Rousey, of course, just had a big moment in women's MMA history, being the first fight to being involved in the first fight on a UFC card, and of course she won by armbar with seconds left in the first round. It was a pretty competitive fight overall until that point. But now, of course, right after the fight, there was a little bit of a story about Gina Carano, and how she's left the door slightly open to come back to MMA. But she's also got all these gigs in Hollywood now, so she really doesn't have any big, huge reasons to come back. Well, now it appears that Ronda Rousey has actually already signed with William Morris Endeavor, one of the world's most prestigious talent and literary agencies. And it's actually run by a guy named Ari Emanuel, who is, cousins with Rahm Emanuel, who is the mayor of Chicago, and he also has been portrayed, a character based on him has been portrayed in the hit show Entourage. That's Ari Gold. But anyway, Ronda signed with them. There was immediately after the fight, there was rumors, obviously they're probably true now, she's signing with a talent agency, that she's going to be in the next Hunger Games movie, and she might be in the third Hunger Games movie after that, because I guess they're going to be doing at least three of them. So, you know, it looks like she's going to follow in Gina Carano's footsteps. She's 7-0 now. And I think Carano was 7-1 when she left the sport, if I remember correctly, something similar to that.
Right.
So Dana White opens the door, and she's going out the back door.
Wow.
I think
that'll be interesting to see if she's going to keep her fight career, because fighting, as we know, is a very jealous mistress. So,
right. We talked a couple times with Kung Lee, who has done a lot of movies, nothing hugely famous that where you might remember seeing him, but he's played some bit roles, some major roles, and some movies that have been bigger overseas. And he probably will be coming out soon with a movie that he had a more solid role in. And he's still fighting in the UFC. He just kind of crossed over right before the Strikeforce collapsed there. So they don't allow you usually to fight in other promotions as part of the UFC, but interestingly enough, they are allowing some of these women that they just signed three more, we'll get to that later, but some of the women that they've signed, they're allowing to fight in Invicta, which they don't own, like Strikeforce they used to own, so that would have made sense, but Invicta, they don't own that, so maybe they're going to make a play for that down the line if they're still letting these ladies fight in that league, but... It's kind of interesting to look at this. And, the UFC has been adamant about stuff like that. You know, you can't compete in other leagues, but obviously you can go to Hollywood and do movies. If Kung Lee has been able to do it, then I guess Rowdy Ronda Rousey can do it. But, of course, Dana White is obviously pissed off. He doesn't like to hear about it. But it's kind of interesting what he said about it. It just proves how dumb Dana White really is. He says, "You know how I feel about the movie stuff. When Rampage did the movie, it was his dream to be part of the A-Team. I don't want to take away any opportunities from Ronda, but at the same time, her window of opportunity as a professional athlete is really narrow. She could make a zillion movies when she retires. She's really going to get the money is here fighting. I don't care if she's the lead role in The Hunger Games 2. She would not make anywhere near, I mean, not even in the universe, to the money she makes fighting." So, you want to put Dana White's little rant to the test, all you got to do is look at Ronda Rousey's payday for her first female fight. $90,000. Now, I don't know what she made in sponsorships and all that on top of that, but it's probably a pretty significant amount of money. If you want to say $500,000, I wouldn't argue with you. But you got to consider how many months did she train for this fight? How many situations is she going to get in a fight where she could possibly be injured compared to the movie industry? And how likely is it she would get paid more than $1 million to do a movie that might take her 2 months to film? You know, she trains for a fight for 3 months, she gets paid $500,000, she gets $1 million for not even taking any risks in a movie for 2 months. I mean, that's pretty logical. You could look at something like that and figure that out. She's with the top talent agency in the world, so she's going to get a good payday for a movie. So Dana White, I mean, he's got to be smoking crack to really believe what he's saying. That she would make more money as an MMA fighter than she would in the movies. I don't know how big the UFC is as far as their income and what they can afford to pay their athletes if they really want to step up. But the highest I've ever seen a guy get paid is Brock Lesnar, and he got $400,000 for one fight. Obviously we don't know a lot about how much people get paid for their sponsorships, but you know, it's tough to believe there's a ton of fighters out there making $1 million or more per fight. Maybe GSP. Some people say he makes $7 million a fight. I find that hard to believe, but he is sponsored by some of the big companies like Nike. John Jones, I could believe, maybe makes over $1 million a fight. But Rousey is really blazing a path here. This is her first fight. She got $90,000. It's going to take her a while to get to that point where she's making $100,000 or $200,000 per fight. So I don't know. I don't know where Dana White gets the idea that she's going to be able to make more as a fighter. And I don't know where he gets the idea that this is going to take away from her fighting, because it seems to me she should be able to balance both. If you look at King Mo, he does professional wrestling and MMA at the same time. So I don't buy that argument from Dana White. And, it's not the first time I've disagreed with him on that point, at any point. But also, speaking of King Mo, he got KTFO'd on last Thursday night. Pretty brutal, spinning back fist to the chin, and he was put down. That was kind of a shocker.
Yeah, I remember thinking is after the first 2 minutes of that fight, I mean, because, you know, going in, of course, everyone knew Emmanuel Newton doesn't have a chance. Everyone knew that, right? Yeah. So I remember thinking after the first 2 minutes, I'm thinking, well, you know, Newton is making a fight out of it. I mean, he's not really running away. He seems like he's pretty aggressive. He's not overly intimidated. And, you know, some of the shots he was throwing were close. And I think that my take on it is King Mo, he'd been working with the Mayweathers quite a bit. And
That's interesting, because I just caught that the other day. Jeff was working on defense with him.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and you know, he kind of had that style that is so effective in boxing if you can do it, and so few guys can do it, you know, where they'll stand in front of you and just make you look silly. But that doesn't account for crazy stuff like a spinning back fist. I mean, that was one of those just perfectly timed, and it wasn't really a wild shot. It was just sort of a short and to the point, right on the button.
Right, and I brought this up before in past interviews with people, and in general, there was a video done by I think it was a Harvard study or a Harvard brain surgeon or scientist or something like that, brought it up on the White Collar Boxing Show, and it was a video of a study they did with monkeys, and they put these little helmets on the monkey's head that made their heads turn rapidly to the side. And they just passed right out. You know, it was just a sudden twitch where they just tweaked their head so hard to the side. And that's exactly what happens when you get hit on the chin with, like, a hard hook. Mm-hmm. Your brain slaps against the side of your head because of that motion. So that's why people talk about, you know, you got a good chin.
Yeah.
Because that's what really creates a lot of those knockouts. If you watch a lot of knockout tapes, you'll see the guy gets hit right on the point of the chin, and his head just twitches to the side. Way more knockouts happen that way than when people get punched in the temple. Both of them happen, obviously, but it's always the chin that seems to create the quickest knockout.
So we can say that the king has been temporarily knocked off his throne. Boy, I wonder how this is going to affect his ego. Ooh.
Yes. Well, he's going to have a couple extra sessions a week with Jeff.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, that was, well, what's that cliche that a defeat either makes you better or finishes you off? So it'll be really interesting to see how he'll come back from this.
Yeah, it's going to take something drastic, I think, to teach him to keep his hands up more. Maybe he's going to have to do something like in the Rocky movie where he had his arm tied to his waist there. Said he's going to have his hands tied to his chin. Mike Tyson style, you know, hands right on the chin, elbows in. That would be a good style for Mo.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. See what happens. Tony, you still there? Mm-hmm. We lost Tony. I knew. I'm talking about Rocky. And Tony's not talking. It's wrong. I knew Tony would have had to chime in right there, so I lost him. But I don't know if you heard it earlier, Tom. We're going to have a guest on the show tonight who's an orthopedic surgeon. Just actually helped Ishe Smith fight Bundridge with a knuckle injury. So think of some good surgeons. There you go.
I'm sorry. I think I hit my hang-up button
moving
my phone, but I wasn't sure.
I just figured out you weren't on the call because I mentioned that one of the Rocky movies where Rocky had to tie his arm to his waist.
Oh, yeah. You know which one that was, of course, right?
I'm drawing a blank.
Aside from being Boxing Rain Man on the Rocky Rain Man, that was Rocky too. Man, I remember that because that's when he... Now, here's the idiot logic of movies. Rocky fought his entire career southpaw, left-handed. Every moment of his boxing career, he was a southpaw. Now, he's getting ready to fight the heavyweight champion of the world, the guy that's undefeated 40-plus-some fights, has destroyed everybody, and now he's going to change his entire style to fight right-handed. Now, if you talk to anybody about boxing... They would say you got to prepare for a southpaw. You got to prepare for a southpaw because, you know, 75% of the fighters out there are right-handed. So basically, you're switching your style, which you've never done, to move to a style that he's seen almost exclusively his entire career. You know, that was the one idiot logic of the movie, but I do enjoy the part where he ties his arm, you know, to his waist, and Mickey's going to make him jab with his left hand. And I enjoy this because my protege, Laura, that I trained a few years ago, and we had her on as a guest, a right-handed girl, had never used her left hand for anything in her entire life. And I tied her right arm to her waist, and I was going to make her, as I said, you got to jab that bag till it hurts. You got to jab it 500 times without stopping. She had never seen Rocky II. She's like, are you serious? I said, yeah, I am. She's just going to jab that bag tonight till it hurts. And I said, you will not stop until the bag says, I hurt, don't hit me anymore. She goes, but it's a bag, you can't talk. I said, then you'll be here for a while now, won't you?
Well, I was bringing up the analogy because King Mo was talked about the last couple of weeks. He was showing some good boxing there at the Bellator circuit, and he got knocked out by a guy named Joel Newton, and he just had his hands low, was trying to do that showy, flashy style, with his hands down fighting and moving the head, but he just didn't have enough head movement, I guess, because he got clocked with a spinning back fist. And we talked about he's been working with Jeff Maitland on defense specifically for the promo show, so... Maybe he needs to have his hands taped to his chin or something.
Yeah.
Or fashion. Another story about MMA, but also a little bit about boxing. I wanted to mention Holly Holm has a 32-3 record as a female boxer, and she's stepping over to MMA. She's actually going against a girl from Massachusetts, my old stomping grounds there. And she's going to be making her third mixed martial arts appearance on Spike TV. I don't know if it's tonight.
I think I read that it was tonight.
It is tonight. She's going to fight Katie Merrill of Brighton, Massachusetts, who is 1-0-0. Brighton's sort of on the outskirts of Boston there. So it's a big city girl against a girl from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she works out with Mike Winklejohn and the Jackson camp out there. And that's one of those things where she's obviously going to be naturally skilled in the boxing, but I think it's going to translate well to MMA. She's already had sparring sessions with John Jones over there at the Jackson gym. And she's done some kickboxing in the past, not professionally, but, you know, as a workout method. So I think she's going to translate well, and I wouldn't be too surprised if you see her facing Ronda Rousey at some point, rather than some of these women that have been around for a while in MMA. I would actually give her a pretty good chance to, she could figure out how to make sure that Rousey couldn't take her down. An armbar. I would give her a good shot against Rousey.
Well, let's see how she does tonight.
Right. Don't count our chickens before they're hatched. But she's 2-0. She hasn't fought really any tough competition. It's mostly people with one or two fights. So, you know, she's kind of easing her way into the sport. We'll have to see how she does. But I'm encouraged. I like her chances. So. a tough young lady. Now, we are obviously mentioned last week all about the UFC cutting fighters left and right. I haven't really done much investigation of this, but I noticed that Josh Gross has written a couple articles on this. And he came out with one today, based mostly on Matt Riddle getting cut for not losing a fight, but failing a second drug test in a matter of three fights, I guess. And this one was caught by the UFC, so it kind of goes to show you that the UFC, when they have to test their own fighters, which they did for the fight in Ireland, that he actually won by split decision over Jay Mills, they actually do a pretty good job testing, I guess, because they caught him. But he claims he quit 3 weeks before the fight. And he's actually one of those card-carrying users, I guess you could call him. He has a medical card up there in Nevada. So, he's kind of trying to make a big stink about it. There was another article I read today that he says MMA and the UFC have something against weed smokers. But I don't know. I don't know if it's, worth defending a guy like that.
So he says he has a card from Nevada. Last I knew, Nevada didn't recognize that.
No, they do.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
They do. They just have a weird setup. They don't allow providers of it. Like Colorado has, dispensaries. And Nevada doesn't allow that. They make you grow your own. So it's kind of a complicated
thing. Yeah, now California has a lot of shops too, I guess.
Right. So he's been talking a little too much, I guess. And Josh Gross brings up kind of some good points about it. That should not put the same policy a second time should result in other guys getting cut for maybe steroids and stuff like that. And he brings up some good examples of guys who are still in the UFC who have been having their own issues, and they still get kicked around. Dave Herman has already been popped twice for the same thing. Nick Diaz, I think, has one prior issue with pot. I think one in Strikeforce and then one in the UFC. And also he has the press conference deal and the filming issues. So he could be next. John Jones already has a DWI, so maybe the next strike for him, he's out, if you apply the same standard. Of course, Chris Leben, he's got the triple threat there. He's had steroids, drugs, and DUIs. Jeremy Stevens, Gross mentions, he is alleged to have participated in the beating of a guy in a parking lot. And you might remember Dana White tried to bail him out for one of his fights. They wouldn't let him out of jail. So it's very inconsistent across the board when they throw these guys out. And it kind of cries out for some, maybe not a union, but some kind of like players association like the NFL has, where these guys can actually fight back.
I'm looking at this way, Rich, and the other night when I was down in Clearwater, I was at the One Sports Bar, and, they had ESPN on the one channel, and, of course, the ticker tape at the bottom going, and that's what I was talking about, Dana White throwing out, picking out 13 fighters. And, I'm sitting there saying, man, I cannot wait to see tonight's show, because I'm gonna blast them, and I got all these great things that were forming in my mind. But then, unfortunately, about 11 7-7 formed in my mind, and a couple of dirty Girl Scout drinks and on top of that, I barely was able to walk back to my hotel. But as I've said countless times on this show, when you get into professional boxing, I'm not a huge fan of the alphabet soup that started in the 70s, then really sort of blossoming and exploding in the 80s and 90s, where you got the WBC, the WBA, the IBF, the IBO, the IBU, the NA. Well, I like the NABF and the USBA because they're more regional, localized titles. And now you're getting intercontinental, international, junior, diamond, silver, super. all this bullshit. But here's the fact of the matter is, you get a guy, he's a professional fighter, and he might lose some fights, but he can still keep fighting, you know. He might have to come back and rebuild himself, and that's fine. And then he can eventually challenge for another title. And I think, what's Dana having there? It's like, three straight losses and you're out?
Now it's been revealed that in these fighters' contracts that after any loss, they can be cut. It doesn't matter if it's three.
And that's bullshit, because you put together a fight card, you have 11 fighters on the card, or 11 fights on the card. Here you're having 22 fighters. Likely you're going to have 11 winners and 11 losers. I mean, you might get a freak draw in there somewhere, but say, if all goes right, you have 11 winners, 11 losers. So you could potentially cut 11 quality fighters into one card. And I just think that's egotistical, and it's idiotic. And the one guy I am going to bring up, he's my poster child for this in the field of boxing, is Arturo Gatti. Gatti wasn't the best fighter out there, but Arturo always sold tickets, and Arturo always made money. I just finished reading an article on him in last month's Ring magazine talking about his induction to the Boxing Hall of Fame, unfortunately, you know, a couple years after his passing. But his manager came out there and said, Arturo would fight on Saturday, and Pat Lynch, his manager, would be getting calls on Monday or Tuesday asking when he would be fighting again. The guy would have fresh stitches in his face, and the swelling hadn't gone down yet, and they're already asking when he's going to fight again. I know.
Well, the thing with Dana White, I mean, he doesn't necessarily punish people just for losing. His thing is you have to put on a show. That's the number one quality that he looks for to keep a fighter around.
And maybe have a good personal relationship with him. I mean, it kind of smashes some of that, too.
Obviously, that's a factor. You have to kiss up to the boss. But like, Gatti would not get cut from the UFC. He could lose four fights in a row, and he would not get cut. But we'll get back to this point later. We actually have to connect with Dr. Jones here. And he's calling right from Vegas. So how's it going, Dr. Jones?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Give us a little rundown of how you helped Ishae Smith with this past fight of his knuckle injury.
Yeah, Ishae was referred to me by another boxer in his camp that I had taken care of, and Ishae had bruised one of his knuckles really bad in a fight, and it had gotten to the point where it was really difficult for him to even throw a punch or land a punch just because of the pain that he was having. And it essentially diagnosed him with an injury to his extensor tendon, which is a tendon that allows him to straighten the finger right over the knuckle of his hand. And so we put him on a little treatment course in an effort to get him back into fighting shape, and it worked out well.
Awesome. Now, how did you get your start in medicine there as an orthopedic surgeon?
I got interested in orthopedics while in medical school, and then interested in hand surgery while I was doing my orthopedic surgery residency, and just enjoyed, you know, the variety of the injuries. You know, the hand is a really complex structure, so it was really challenging, and I kind of wanted to be the guy that would be able to take care of stuff that nobody else really wanted to take care of, so many reasons, but mainly just because I love the type of people that I come across, the type of injuries that I see, and the hand in general. So it's a beautiful structure and fun to take care of.
Cool. So being out in Las Vegas, the fight capital of the world, I would think that you must run into a lot of fighters, right?
Yeah.
Boxing.
Yes. Yeah. Some boxers in particular. You know, it just happens to be one of those sports where they make a living with their hands. So, as a result of what they do with their hands, there's quite a few injuries that they incur. So, yeah, we see a lot of it.
What's the worst case scenario you've seen so far?
I've seen a couple of ligament injuries. I've fixed a boxer out here, up and coming guy. He had a bad injury to his wrist that required surgery. I had to reconstruct a ligament in his wrist to hold the tendon in place. And then he also had a an injury to his elbow, similar to what baseball players get, especially pitchers. And essentially I had to do a Tommy John surgery on him to reconstruct that ligament in his elbow. So that's about the most severe I've seen in a boxer. Pretty rare injury, actually, in a boxer, but that's about the worst I've seen in a professional fighter so far.
Yeah, I got my own elbow injury right now. It's something that just doesn't quite heal. I do a lot of lumberjack work, so I think it's picking up split logs with one hand.
It's a little tennis elbow or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's probably something similar. Because I run a chainsaw, too. That probably doesn't help.
Yeah, that's right. You're using that hand a lot, it sounds like.
What can people do as a fighter, just as a regular person, to strengthen those type of areas, like an elbow and a hand?
Well, you know, a lot of it is sort of sport-specific. You know, since we're talking about boxing, I think it's important that boxers do the necessary preparation, making sure that their trainers or themselves take their hands appropriately, wear the appropriate size glove and the appropriate glove when it comes to, heavy bag work or any other type of sparring they may be doing, and not skipping any precautions. Make sure they take the necessary precautions to prevent injury. So I think that's the most important thing, not trying to take any shortcuts.
Right, yeah. So, I can remember when I first got a real lesson on how to wrap my hands.
Yeah.
The coach from the Air Force Academy, where I was a student there as a freshman, took us through the drill, and then he explained, that you really have to wrap your wrist a lot because people don't understand when they shouldn't let people show you how to wrap your hands, that it's 90% of it is the wrist, because if you don't wrap your wrists right, you can break your wrists a lot easier than you break your hands.
Yeah, absolutely. You raise a very good point. Yeah, absolutely. That wrist absorbs 100% of everything that comes through that hand. So, right, that has to be adequately taped as well.
I always remember during my fighting career. Almost wrist beat a month or so later. And I hurt my left hand so bad in the first round. I remember going back to the coach and saying, "Coach, the left hand is gone." And he goes, "Well, use your right hand." And I did. And I go back into the second round, and I swear this kid had cement in his head because I said, "Coach, the right hand is gone." He goes, "Box, move. Just do whatever you do to get to this last round." I think we got the fight, one on the cards.
Yeah.
And I didn't get the decision. And I just remember taking the glove off. I thought they were both broken. They weren't. They were just, the kid had just a hard head. But the actual worst hand injury I ever had happened about 6 months later. I wasn't able to box on the college team anymore. I used my 4 years up. And I was helping coach with the team, but I was bored. I wanted to do something, and some of my roommates got me to sign up for a flag football league. And, hey, sounded like a lot of fun. We were in the semifinals, and kid was running kind of away from me, and I'm reaching out to grab it, and he made a cutback. And I actually caught my thumb on my right hand on the inner side of his leg, and he cut back, and that thing just yanked. And I remember just going back and putting ice on it, and I'm like, "I think I jammed it. I think I jammed it." And the next day, I saw one of the trainers, and he's like, "You didn't jam any years. No, you probably broke that." Well, I didn't break it. I had torn ligaments.
Yeah.
And so when I went to the original hospital, they made a diagnosis of just a sprain and put me in a brace for about 7 days. And when I got home from graduating a month later, I was just noticing I was trying to pick up a football. I couldn't grip it. I was trying to pick up a baseball. I couldn't grip it. And then a few months later, I was still having problems picking things up, and I couldn't shake a hand. And I ended up going to a hand specialist, and he before he even did any tests on me, any real MRIs or things like that. He's like, "I can tell you right now, you tore ligaments."
Yeah.
And but so many months later, he goes, See, because that hospital misdiagnosed you. It's probably a first-year resident in there just saying, oh, I think you sprained it. You should be fine. And that took me out for about a good 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, no, those, you know, people think that, oh, it's just a ligament tear or it's just a sprain, but, you know, oftentimes it's the little things, like, you know, like Ishay Smith, you know, he didn't break anything, but you know, if you get a bruised knuckle or a bruised bone or a sprain of a ligament or a tendon, that oftentimes can be just as potentially devastating as a fracture. And in your case, you know, those ligaments, that particular ligament that you tore is extremely important to the thumb, especially when it comes to gripping and grasping objects. So, and if it's not detected, you know, in a timely manner, then like you said, I mean, it can be a long road to recovery. I mean, oftentimes you have to do a surgery to reconstruct it if it's not working, or, you know, prolonged period of time in a cast. So, yeah, just because something's not broken doesn't mean it's a benign injury.
What made it even worse for me was right before that happened, I had a small little problem with my left thumb where I got a splinter and got it embedded into one of the little blood vessels in there, and it got infected, so they had to do a minor outpatient, you know, cut me open to get that out. So
yeah,
my whole left thumb had been wrapped up. So I shouldn't have been playing flag football, but I wanted to play because it was the semifinals. So now I got torn ligaments in the right thumb. I got my whole left thumb wrapped up, and now I'm trying to carry my my tray with my lunch from the cafeteria with my little juice glasses on there. I'm like, I have no thumbs. I really feel this is what separates humans from the animals are these two things that I can't use really anymore.
Oh, yeah. You know, we take so many things for granted on a daily basis until we don't have them. And, so you definitely need your thumbs. So.
Now, in Smith's case, how were you able to treat him without having to put him in surgery?
Well, you know, we made sure that he got adequate rest, mainly. I placed him into a small splint as well to kind of help immobilize the knuckle and the joint for a period of time, just to sort of allow the tissue to mend, and to also remind him, you know, to, hey, take it easy. This isn't anything that you want to mess with right now. And we rested him for a good 6 weeks of no contact with the hand. You know, during that period of time, he could still condition, he could still, you know, shadow box and that type of thing, but during that 6 weeks, absolutely no contact. And then it was a gradual thing, you know, and then over the next 4 to 6 weeks thereafter, we started gradually getting back into it. Had to give him a little cortisone injection about 6 to 8 weeks after the initial injury because he was still having some tenderness. But then after adequate rest, a little cortisone shot, some splinting, we let him go to start making contact and getting trained up for the fight, and it worked out. So,
and you talked to him since the fight, right?
I called and congratulated him. I haven't spoken to him personally, but I take it no news is good news. the hand looks like it worked out well for him. So,
So what's that like being able to kind of impact the world stage like that as a surgeon?
It's extremely gratifying. I mean, I'm definitely grateful for the opportunity to have helped somebody of Ishay's caliber, and I'm just one part of the whole cycle, the team, but it's definitely fun to be able to contribute to that process, and it was certainly, you know, rewarding to see him win that World Championship. So it was great, very gratifying, very grateful for the opportunity to help him.
Dr. Jones, do you feel that most of the damage that you see to fighters' hands is an accumulation of just a lot of wear and tear, or like a kind of like a one-time traumatic event? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, it seems like certainly the trauma to somebody's hand can be sort of cumulative over time. It seems, though, however, that you know, boxers have they seem to be able to, their hands seem to be able to adapt to that constant contact. either through calluses or what have you. And so it seems like most of the stuff that I'm seeing is pretty acute injuries,
mm-hmm.
Rather than the chronic stuff, rather than the cumulative stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In Ishe's case, again, like a bruised knuckle, or the occasional fracture, ligament tears, most of it's acute stuff.
And what's the best pair of hands you've ever seen on a fighter?
The best pair of hands, I don't know. They all got good hands, so I don't think I have a favorite.
But what makes a good strength in your hand? Can you give us any examples of, is it genetics? Is it just working it like you said, or is there
to getting strength in the hand, is that what your question was?
Right.
There's no real trick. A lot of the upper extremity work that guys do, strengthening their forearms, strengthening their grip strength and all that stuff with various modalities, be it with weights or hand weights or squeezy balls and that type of thing. I mean, those are even gripping a bar, doing pull-ups and chin-ups and that type of thing. I mean, that increases your forearm strength, which increases your grip strength. So I can't say that there's really, at least I've not seen anybody with genetically superior hands. I'm sure if somebody was to do a anthropologic study or something, they might be able to come up with something. No real trick, just making sure that you do the adequate upper body strengthening will usually get them adequate hand strength.
And what would you say is the ultimate goal for you in your field?
I just enjoy taking care of people. I enjoy it. I enjoy taking care of these conditions. This is what every physician wants, is to be able this is why we go into medicine, is to be able to make somebody better so that they can do something with their hands, so that they can get on with their life. Somebody has a setback and you fix it. And they're able to go on and do great things, or be able to get back to their job. I mean, I can't say that I necessarily have a goal other than just to keep doing that type of stuff and enjoying it. So.
Now, Tony was just talking about a situation where he got an injury and got reminded of how important his stuff was. Do you find that a lot of people, when they injure their hands, they say, oh, geez, I didn't realize how much I use my hands.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Like we were just talking about it, we definitely take for granted a lot of things until we don't have them. And I see that a lot in patients, who they say to me all the time, oh, I just can't believe how important my hands are, especially when they can't use them after an injury or something, or a prolonged rehabilitation process. You really get a newfound appreciation for the hands. So.
I do a lot of writing on the computer and stuff like that. And when I was working for a newspaper, there was a guy who worked across from me. He was like a senior reporter. And he used to always tell me I was going to get carpal tunnel syndrome because of the way I typed. And he had just had surgery for it, so he should have known, I was just wondering out of curiosity, is there anything that you could do to try to avoid that, or is there any supplements you could take or anything like that?
Well, not really any supplements, carpal tunnel syndrome, the cause of carpal tunnel syndrome, well, first of all, there's a number of different causes of the carpal tunnel syndrome. Hormonal changes, obesity, smoking, it seems like women get it more often than men for whatever reason. There's been a lot of studies done to look at a correlation between overuse, like typing, and whether or not that correlates to a higher incidence of carpal tunnel syndrome. And a lot of those studies, which have been good scientific studies, have come back showing no real correlation, surprisingly, between the amount of typing and the incidence of carpal tunnel syndrome. So it may contribute to it, but it won't necessarily cause it. In terms of what you can do to prevent it, like I said, no supplements. making sure that your sitting at your desk properly and making sure that your wrist is sort of in a neutral position when you're typing, that it's not hyperextended or hyperflexed. Those types of things can definitely, I think, probably decrease the incidence or decrease the chance that you'll develop it. But other than that, you know, probably not. If you're going to get it, you're going to get it.
I always kind of looked at it funny whenever he mentioned that, and I never had a problem from typing. But
yeah.
I had all the symptoms from doing too much sawing with the chainsaw a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there's a pretty good correlation between carpal tunnel syndrome and the use of vibratory tools, you know, like jackhammers, or in your case, chainsaws, and that type of thing. Certainly that type of thing can cause an inflammation of the tendons in the wrist, which may put pressure on that nerve and cause carpal tunnel syndrome. So I think there's a better correlation between using chainsaws and jackhammers as opposed to typing.
Yeah, and I always found whenever I had any kind of symptoms, actually boxing was good for it. Hitting the bag,
yeah.
It seemed to shorten my wrists a lot.
Uh-huh.
So, maybe I need to do more of that after I change it.
Yeah, and it could be the taping of the wrist, you know, keeping that wrist nice and neutral in that straight position maybe kind of helped it too, so, yeah.
Now, what would you say you enjoy most about doing your job on a daily basis, helping people?
Oh, you know, I think what I enjoy the most, you know, I just enjoy people. I enjoy seeing people get back to doing what they were doing before. You know, obviously, in Ishe Smith's case, you know, you couldn't ask for anything better. Being able to help a guy out and hopefully that helped him, you know, win the world title or was one of many things that helped him accomplish what he wanted to accomplish. And that's what I enjoy the most. Yeah.
Now, do you watch a lot of boxing or MMA or anything like that? Are you a fan of
Yeah,
that
you know, occasionally. I'm getting more into it now that I have some boxers as patients. So, I actually did a little bit of boxing when I was in residency in Indiana. Joined a boxing gym there and did a little bit of it myself for about a year and a half, 2 years. So I kind of have an appreciation of you know the type of conditioning that it takes to be a boxer and certainly you know taping techniques and the types of training that a boxer goes through. So I feel like I have a pretty good appreciation for that.
It's funny you mentioned Indiana, because we were just cracking a joke earlier in the show about Dr. Jones and Indiana Jones.
Yeah, that's where I did all Yeah, that's where I did all my training, was Indiana University. So
that would have been a great fighting nickname for you.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. I'll have to keep that one in mind. If this doctor thing doesn't work out, I'll be on the... maybe you'll see me somewhere. I don't know.
So tell us a little bit about some other cases, either boxing or not boxing related, just cases where you really helped somebody out and it really worked out great for them. And
You know, I see some, you know, out here in Vegas... you get all sorts of sports. You get boxing, stuff like that. You get a lot of motocross people, and so we come across a lot of wrist fractures from motocross racers and that type of thing. Skiers, snowboarders, and that type of thing. And so we do a lot of both non-operative and surgical management of those types of injuries. I've treated a number of those people that have allowed them to get back to their sport. We also cover a lot of the level one trauma that comes through the major county hospital here in Las Vegas. And you see anything from, you know, chainsaw injuries to table saw injuries to gunshot wounds and all sorts of things. And so putting mangled hands and arms back together again is extremely gratifying. It can be tough work and work that comes in the middle of the night, but we do a lot of that. We try to get people back to you know what they love doing, and that's being productive with their hands.
So you get called in a lot on the emergency room work too, huh?
We do. We do a lot of emergency room work out here. Yep, a lot of it.
So do you have a private admission to that, or is it just something that people get referred to you in the hospital? Do you have your own show?
You're kind of breaking up a little bit. Can you repeat that question?
Blog Talk Radio page is frozen.
Hey!
It's weird that but it says I'm still connected to Blog Talk Radio, so I don't know what's going on. My computer's... Okay, we are back.
I'm still here. I'm here.
Hello, Dr. Jones.
Yes, I'm here.
All right, we had a little glitch there. The website froze for a radio show for a second. I don't know what happened there.
No worries.
I was right when I was cutting out. Do you remember what I asked you before then?
Let's see.
We were just talking about generally... Do you have a regular side practice, or does most of your work come through the hospital?
Yeah, no, we get quite a few patients through the hospital, and then word of mouth referrals from other physicians, insurance companies, and that type of thing. I'm one of the hand doctors in my group, and so we cover a lot of the valley, and we get patients from everywhere. And from all different venues, ER, you know, gyms, pay, you know, other doctors, that type of thing. So,
cool. And how do people find you if they have an injury that they want to take directly to you if they're listening to the show?
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I'm one of the hand surgeons with Hand Surgery Specialists of Nevada here in Las Vegas, and our phone number is 702-645-7800, and our website is hssnv.com. I've got a side website called drjedjones.com, just where I write some weekly blog articles regarding various topics in hand surgery and that type of thing. But you can contact us through the internet, through the phone number. Happy to see you.
I hope you have good ergonomics on your desk so you don't get carpal tunnel syndrome.
Yeah, I try. So.
All right. Well, have you guys got any more questions for the doctor?
Oh, no, just I know all about what it's like to, you know, when you're in there and your hands are, you know, your livelihood and they're not working right, you know, how bad that can be. I mean, just a bruised knuckle. I was horse around a few months ago and then playing with a friend of mine, and we were just boxing around a little bit, and then I accidentally missed the one shot. I have one prominent knuckle on each hand, and I hit a pole with it. And
yeah.
I mean, some days I would just try to pick something up, and it would hurt. It was just a bad bruise.
Yeah.
You know, just, I mean, a simple task. I got to start a chainsaw, you know, because we on Christmas trees, and just trying to grip the chainsaw with my left hand to start it with my right, and I can't grip it. You know, people don't realize that, you know, until it happens to them. So
right.
It was nice when Isha won that fight the other night. You could tell he was a very emotional, fighter. And, you know, some people said, why was he acting like that? What, is he a crybaby or something? I said, until you guys go out there and try something and sometimes fail a few times or fall short of your goal a few times, and then you finally get it, and, you know, it's an overwhelming feeling, and especially when you're in a situation where, you know, maybe a few weeks or a few months prior, it didn't look like you were going to be able to do anything. And that can be very, very overwhelming. And it was a breath of fresh air to really see him genuinely break down like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It really was, and I thought him being emotional was fantastic. I mean, he's just a poster boy for resiliency and persistence, and it's really the most persistent, determined person that's going to come out on top all the time. I mean, thinking about and reading about all the stuff that he had to overcome, to get where he was, it's really a true champion story. So he's really a true champion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Tom, you got anything else?
I think this covers everything quite a bit. Pretty good. So.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Is there anybody you want to give a shout out to or say hello to before we go?
Oh yeah, I'd love to give a shout out to Ishay Smith, true champion. Love you. Congratulations.
All right, well, keep up the good work, and like you said, find them in the Vegas area if you have a problem. If you want your hand fixed, he's the guy. Elbow, too, right? Do the elbow and anything.
That's right, yeah.
All right, well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll definitely keep in touch.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye. All right, so there's Dr. Jones. We still got quite a bit of stories here to cover. Of course, we haven't gone over the UFC results from this last week. We were just in the middle of something. I kind of wanted to finish that topic that we were discussing right before we got Dr. Jones on the phone of the cuts. And these guys getting cut for just arbitrary reasons. I don't mind guys getting cut. Or like the old three strikes, you're out rule. I didn't really have a problem with that, but my problem came up when you had a guy like Dan Hardy who had lost four fights, and they didn't cut him. But they're cutting other guys that had three fights. But my main concern is that they have to have a uniform situation where, you know, they can't just randomly cut these people and have no logic to it. And the other part of it is, why are they cutting people? Some of these MMA journalists out there really need to start asking that question, not just getting fed the information that Dana White is putting out there. Well, we have to make room for these guys from the Tough Series or for the women or for the Strikeforce people. Well, then the next logical question should be, why do you have to make room? Don't you guys have enough money to pay these people, to keep them on the payroll? Even if they don't fight in 6 months or something, you know, give them some time off. Suspend them for a little while, an informal suspension. Oh, you had a crappy fight. We're going to put you on the shelf for a little while. I think these guys will be fine with that. But just cutting them from the organization altogether, especially when they're big draws and big names that people like to fight, like to see fight.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at it, it's like, I've always been a boxing guy. So, I mean, that's kind of where I go. Now, if I look at it this way, okay, say Don King has a fighter, you know, or Golden Boy has a fighter, or Mayweather Promotions, or Bob Arum and Top Rank, whoever. They have a fighter. And for whatever reason, you know, this fighter is losing money, this fighter is nothing, whatever. And Bob Arum or Don King or Golden Boy, they settle the contract with, and I'll just pull out a name, you know, just say Tavoris Cloud coming up in a few weeks instead of Bernard Hopkins. and he is one of Don King's last champions. This is my one to talk about a little bit later, too. And say Bernard Hopkins beats Tavoris Crap. Don King says, you know what, Tavoris, it ain't working. You know, I'm cutting you from my, promotional stable. Tavoris Crap can still compete as a professional boxer. You know, in boxing, there isn't a league. There isn't a UFC. There isn't a Strikeforce. There isn't a Bellator. There isn't, you know, a Puff or all these different organizations. And boxing is boxing. I mean, a lot of times promoters will keep guys from fighting guys from other promotional stables. So say Tavoris Brown gets cut by Don King. And now, Bernard Hopkins is, say, a Don King fighter. And, well, you know, Don King's like, Tavoris, I'm done with you. I don't want you fighting any of my fighters anymore. But Tavoris, signs on with Bob Arum, or he signs on with Golden Boy, and he starts winning some fights again. Well, lo and behold, Tavoris becomes the number one contender. He's the mandatory challenger. And you know what happens? Whether Don King likes it or not, he gets a title shot. You know, I know there's always going to be, oh, we'll pay you money to step aside so we can fight another Don King fighter. And a lot of those political moves that have happened way too often. Well, I remember back in the 90s when Don King and Jose Suleiman were real buddy-buddy. I mean, Mike Tyson, the day he got out of prison in 1995, hadn't fought in 4 years. The day he stepped out of prison and re-signed with Don King, became the WBC number one contender, Jose Suleiman's organization, without even stepping in the gym one day. There's always a little bit of shadiness out there sometimes, but overall, you know, just because you might lose a contract with a promoter doesn't mean you still can't fight.
I think boxing could teach MMA a little bit of a lesson as far as, you know, how people get back into the fold if they've had a loss or two. You know, they just sort of have to build themselves, like you say. But something else that just came to mind, I mean, in Matt Riddle's case, the most recent guy to get cut, it's not really a matter of performance. He's had his whole career inside the UFC, straight out of the Tough Series. So it's just pretty impressive that he's been able to do that. He made his pro debut in the cage, the Octagon. And also, the thing that he got busted for was technically legal in his home state. It might be illegal in the federal government. It might be against the rules. It's against the rules in the commission. But Ireland actually doesn't have a commission, so it was an interesting little sidelight that he is not going to get suspended because there's no commission over there. So he could go to any organization and fight again as long as he tests clean. But the thing is, Dana White was just recently out there with a story that he didn't want to do random drug testing because half of his guys would end up getting popped for marijuana. So he throws this guy out for testing positive for it, when on the other hand, just a few weeks ago, he was talking about how many guys he knows are addicted to it and on it. And that's why they don't do random testing. So it's good for some people as long as they keep it a secret. I mean, what is the big deal? I just don't get it. But, I mean, Matt Riddle's kind of a bad example because, you know, it's a drug thing rather than a performance thing. And I think the biggest problem I have is more to do with the whole idea of putting on a show. And that sort of becomes dangerous in the respect where, you know, you put two guys out there and one guy wants to fight a technical fight, not only because that's what his strength is, maybe he feels that that's the best way to prevent an injury. You know, you want to have a full MMA career, and guys have said this before, that, they didn't want to hurt themselves. So, I mean, you look at a show like The Ultimate Fighter, perfect example. I think that the idea is to get through that show without hurting yourself. And to have to cut all that weight and to have all those fights in that short amount of time, there's a lot of danger of hurting yourself. So guys will want to have technical fights. You have the bonus system, and you have the added problem in the major leagues there, the actual pros of the UFC, where it's not an exhibition fight, like, where you have to put on a show to lose. And guys are going to end up putting themselves at risk to do that. And there's going to be more injuries as a result of that, I think. It's maybe not going to be something that you see in every card, But over time, if they keep putting that emphasis on and they keep starting to throw these guys out for the most limited bad night, one bad night, you're going to see a lot of these guys take way too many risks just to put on a show. And I think that's where the UFC is going to get themselves into trouble. Somebody's going to end up suing them for it and winning. Hopefully. I don't know. Something's got to change there, I think. But I think we beat that dead horse.
Well, I can just see Dana, though, saying, yeah, we do have uniform standards. What I say.
Yeah.
Very uniform standards, okay? I didn't like him. He's gone, okay? He's boring. He's gone. But this other guy lost five in a row, but I like him. He stays. The standards are uniform.
Right. Exactly. And that's the problem with Dana White, too. I mean, we could have a whole show on Dana White's problems, but...
Mm-hmm.
His attitude and his ego is number one. And what pisses me off more than anything is, all right, you know, you can criticize a fight and say that wasn't a great fight, but once you start tearing into these fighters and talking about they didn't put on a show or they didn't do this and they didn't do that, all I got to say is, all right, Mr. Boxing Science Instructor, come back to me when you actually fought in the cage. Because, I mean... You know, obviously he's the president, he has to comment on some of these things, but to take some of these guys to task like he does and taking that attitude like, I'm the greatest guy in the world who knows everything about fighting, so I can say this, I mean, that's just bunk. And he's just not, he's not experienced enough to make those kind of comments, and you know, he's not coming from a position of experience himself, so... just doesn't hold a lot of weight to me, and I just can't believe how many people just eat out of his hand, especially some of the MMA reporters. I mean, I understand that it's a system where if, like a fighter, if you're not having a good relationship with Dana White, you're not getting the story. And like with a fighter, if you don't have a good relationship with him, you're not getting your fight.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's a lot to do with you know, why he gets away with as much as he gets away with. But, you know, he's got the abrasive language, too. Some people don't like it, but a lot of people think, oh, it makes him seem like a real man, you know, a real guy, a regular guy. So they just kind of gravitate towards that.
Well, you know, and you also wonder, too, just how they've avoided some antitrust actions. Because a lot of these things just really, I mean, I'm not a lawyer just by any stretch. I'm not an expert on it, but you got to ask a few questions about this.
Well, I have a couple theories on that. Number one, they're huge taxpayers in Nevada. The Fertittas are very big, very good friends with Harry Reid. Done a lot of campaign contributions. You know, so they have friends in high places. They have associations to also have friends in high places. And they have a lot of money. So if somebody to come after them in the criminal realm, they're going to put their lawyers on it all day long. And they only have to pay their lawyers a certain amount. The government is not going to devote the resources it's going to take to convict them. They're just not going to do it. Especially now with these cutbacks. You know, they're not going to go out of their way to spend 2 or 3 years trying to bust somebody for something that's probably pretty thin to begin with. Because there are some antitrust issues, but they're sort of borderline issues at this point. You have enough competition in the marketplace to negate their monopoly over certain things. You know, the biggest glaring thing, like as I know from doing the Zion story, is that they've had a lot of situations with conflicts of interest. And, you know, loan is banking fraud. And the government looked away on a lot of that stuff. Even the U.S. bankruptcy trustee that worked on the case had him red-handed with documentation proving that they could have sold the company to Cott for $150 million, and they didn't do it. They didn't bail the company out and save the shareholders. They just bankrupted it and ended up back with them. And they got away with that. They destroyed evidence. They destroyed evidence, and the trustee caught him with that and had him red-handed. The judge ruled that they violated the rules of evidence. And they still let the trustee still let him off with a slap on the wrist because he knew going to trial was going to cost way too much money and there was going to be nothing left for the creditors. So it's just one of those situations where they know lawyers will save them more money than anything. They just hire good lawyers. They can do whatever they want. And they just know how to work the system. It's one of those things. I mean, you look at their father, Frank Fertitta Jr. He was actually one of the characters in the movie Casino. And if you read about his background and what he got away with the skimming, every friend basically went to jail. He was the only one that didn't go to jail. You kind of wonder what ace in the hole he pulled off.
Mm-hmm.
And even perhaps the foundation that he was able to pass on to his sons before he died. So it's friends in high places. It's the basic character of that family has been able to fly under the radar. Way back, history in Texas had a situation where gambling was illegal. And these guys had a casino right off the coast, literally on top of the water, on a pier. And it was called the Balinese Room down there in Texas on the shoreline. And when they had their casino nights, they would have people watching to see when the state troopers were, or the Texas Rangers were coming down the pier. So then everybody would basically, you know, turn the speakeasy back into a regular bar by the time the guys got there. So they never got busted. So it's just, there's a lot of factors there, but it's just a slick family to begin with who started all this, so... Able to get away with a lot of stuff, and 90% of it is not making anything public. Of course, they do make the salaries public and stuff like that, but there's locker room bonuses, there's, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff that we'll never know about. And it's just one of those things. It's very complicated, and that's the way they like it. That's the way they've been able to get away with things, because they can make it complicated. And, you know, the situation with Zion's the thing that baffled me. I eventually figured it out, but, you know, and they set up the bankruptcy so that they had somebody come in and put in what's called a stalking horse bid. And those people were associated with COT, which is the company that bottles or cans of energy. So there's these two executives that used to work for COT. They set up this shell company in Canada. That company actually buys Zions out of bankruptcy, but they buy it on a payment plan. So what ends up happening is the Fertitta Enterprises is the owner going into bankruptcy. Once the bankruptcy is concluded and there's a reorganization plan in place, this company takes it over. They have another name. It was Manzan, I think they called it. And they just stopped making payments. So the company ends up going back to the Fertittas. Now, one of the biggest bones to pick in the bankruptcy was COT. COT had $8 million worth of science product that was already canned, and they couldn't sell it until they did a deal with the UFC to make sure that the marketing expenses were covered. So, in other words, they didn't have a deal to have the UFC logo on the COT cans. So when the UFC came in and bailed out Zions, the Fertittas came in and bailed out Zions, they had to pay themselves a marketing fee, basically, to make sure that those COT cans went out to market. So it was all a big circular conspiracy there for them to be able to get away with that and then end up with the company by default. But nobody ever called them on it because it was so many different people removed from, you know, the actual Fertittas. It wasn't the UFC, Zuffa LLC that owned the company. It was Fertitta Enterprises. So it's just you have to admire it in some sense, but you also have to realize it's pretty despicable stuff that they were able to get away with, and especially when you consider all the shareholders that got burnt in that situation. And if they can get away with something like that that's been blasted all over the internet now, other sites have even covered it, obviously they're getting away with a lot more serious stuff. And I think that's what it really boils down to in the end, is that you let somebody get away with something small, and they're gonna do something bigger the next time. And they're going to graduate to bigger and bigger stuff. Every time they get away with a scam, the next time it's going to be bigger. And that's why they've been able to get away with such epic stuff. Because nobody's ever thrown a wrench in it at any stage of the process. To say, hey, guys, you can't do that, you know? Just like anything. You know, you go to a store, you steal a candy bar, as a little kid. You graduate to something bigger than that. Maybe you steal a DVD player or something. I mean, eventually you can get up to robbing a bank if you learn how to steal correctly. It's just the way that the system works. But I did want to mention, like I mentioned before, the salaries. When I was talking about Ronda Rousey, I do have a story here about the UFC 157 salaries. And I'll just go ahead and we'll talk about the fights on that card as well while we're going through the salaries. Main event, of course, was Ronda Rousey, $90,000, which was including a $45,000 win bonus, was her base pay. Liz Carmouche, guess how much she made? Anybody?
$30,000.
Whoa! That's what I made in my best year as a newspaper reporter. But she only made $12,000.
Oh!
For being the closest girl to ever fight, the closest to ever taking Ronda out in a submission. There's a picture, actually, at the top of this article of her cranking Ronda's face around. It wasn't as close as people made it out to be because she never actually got her arm under the neck. But there's another move called, as far as a rear naked choke, it wasn't close, but there's another move called a neck crank that usually happens when the fighters are on the ground. I've only seen one fight where somebody actually got a submission out of it. But it's possible, and it was close to something like that, but Ronda had her nose crunched in and her face turned sideways and somehow managed to fight through that and never let her arm get under the chin. But it was close. It was definitely very close. What else doesn't happen often is getting that rear naked choke in a standing position, which is where she ended up with it. But Ronda ended up turning it around, and it was actually a pretty close fight. Ronda was definitely winning on points up until that little episode, and she just ended up getting her on the ground. And of course, they told the story a couple times of how Liz Carmouche in training actually put out a bet that anybody that could submit her in an armbar, whether in actual training or just out of the blue, somebody grabbed her and tried to get her in an armbar and submitted her, then she would buy them a hamburger. She didn't have to buy anybody a hamburger through her whole training camp. But then once they interviewed Ronda about that, she said, well, it wasn't me trying, so that makes no difference to me. And Liz did the classic defense for that arm bar, but Ronda she has an unbelievable technique. And it's like the old Bruce Lee saying about, you can do 10,000 things, one thing 10,000 times. I forget how it actually goes, but
I don't fear the man who's done 10,000 things once. I fear the man who's done one thing 10,000 times.
That's it, yeah. So she proved that to be correct in that fight. And, it's just a testament to, what her goals are and what her background is. And actually, she mentioned in one preview piece about how her mother used to wake her up in the morning by trying to get her in an armbar. So she obviously knows how to defend it, too. But that's just one of those little tricks that she has absolutely mastered. And she's also kept up her streak of first round submissions and finishes. So she hasn't gotten out of the first round yet. It's pretty impressive. She's definitely going to be matched up with the winner of Kat Zingano and Misha Tate. Seems like that's inevitable now. And we also added a few girls. I think I have that story coming up later. But they added a few different girls to the circuit. One of them was Sarah Kaufman. I don't recall the other two off the top of my head. But, Liz got only $12,000 for coming that close. And that's the first female fight in the UFC is a main event. So you'd think she would get a lot more than that. But I think she got shortchanged. Then we had the breadwinner, the big breadwinner, the whole card, fighting in a loss, a losing effort. Actually, he made $250,000, Dan Henderson, in losing to Lyoto Machida, who actually, he's the only one on this card that didn't get a win bonus. He got $200,000 with no win bonus for that fight. And I don't know why, whether Dana was a Dana thing, because he decided he wasn't explosive enough or exciting enough. But,
yeah, I understand. I think Dana was pretty outspoken about that. He just felt it was a very boring effort.
Yeah, and you know, I'm one of those advocates where I really like it when fighters throw a lot of leg kicks, like Dan Henderson was doing. But the problem is he wasn't following it up with anything, and if he was really going to, you know, use that as a strategy, you know, you try to take out the guy's bleed leg so that he can't land punches. And you have to land it a lot more than that. Once he figured out he couldn't land it as easily as he probably should have been able to against a more traditional type of fighter, then he probably should have abandoned that strategy and gone with his better strength, fists. But it's just none of them ever really seemed to be that aggressive. It was almost like they were saving themselves for something.
Yeah.
I was very disappointed in that fight. I thought it would have been more of a slugfest. And it seemed like it would have had to go five rounds for it to be really intense at some point. You know, maybe if it had gone to a fifth round, then they would have put it all out on the line, maybe. But
you know, and when you stop to think about what this has done to Henderson, where he was at a year ago compared to now, I mean, if you look at the knee injury and then adding this, he may be a few fights away from a title shot, if then.
Right.
And it's hard to say where he goes from here. I'm really interested.
Yeah, I think it was a really bad idea for them to call before this fight that the Lyoto Machida, or the winner of this fight, was going to get to fight John Jones. Now Lyoto Machida gets a rematch for, I mean, it's a win, but it's not a pretty win. And it's not, it doesn't show anything that looks like it can be competitive against John Jones.
Thank you. That's just my first reaction was, what is going to be different? Because he's very elusive, but Jones figured out his style once. And if Jones loses the first round like he did the first time around, well, we may just see he'll just go out physicality. If that's the word, physicality. Yeah, just the way he did.
He's such a counterpuncher too, and John Jones is not going to give him an opportunity to counterpunch. Or at least win and score enough points in counterpunching. Dan Henderson allowed that because he only threw a certain amount of punches. He only waited into Machida's range a certain amount of times. And he seemed to definitely be trying to keep his distance. John Jones is not going to do that. He's a very aggressive fighter. He's not only going to be throwing a lot of punches, he's going to be throwing a lot of dynamic kicks, elbows, spinning back fists, spinning back kicks. Machida's not going to be able to handle that with that type of style. And, you know, if he was going to be able to do it, he would have had to make a lot of changes that he should have showcased in this fight.
Yeah, and I would say at this stage,
God, you know,
yeah, exactly. Like at this stage of Machida's career, is he capable of making some dramatic changes? I'd have to question that. So I guess we'll have to sit through and see it again. I mean, again, that old cliche, styles make fights. And that is so true of this one, as I see it. I mean, if I'm wrong, we'll see. But I'm not overly enthused about watching this rematch.
So now we go to Uriah Faber versus Ivan Menjivar. And Faber looked very impressive. He had mentioned, you know, they had fought before. Obviously, they showed the tapes of them fighting before. But this was a completely different fight. That one, the first one, was very competitive. But Uriah is one of those people who actually did do a lot of work and made changes to his game since losing to Barao. And it probably did help in this situation that there was talk before this fight that if he didn't win, he was going to get cut. He was going to be one of the next people on the chopping block, but he made $100,000 for that performance.
You know, it seems like just when I have him written off, he comes back with a performance like this. I mean, it's a hard guy to figure, but this was vintage Faber. This is the Faber of 5 years ago.
And he mentioned in the previews coming up to this fight that he put on 8 pounds of muscle. So obviously that helped him. And he beat Ivan Menjivar, who made $17,000 for his effort. So, not bad for a night's work, but after all the expenses and everything like that, 3 months of training, it's not very good either. But there's a couple guys on this card that got paid less, actually. Multiple guys. But next fight was Court McGee versus Josh Neer. Court McGee from the Ultimate Fighter fame got a $20,000 win bonus and a $20,000 purse. So he made a total of $40,000 for beating Josh Neer, who ended up with $16,000. Neer just did not seem like himself in this fight. I don't know whether he's getting too old for this or just bad style for him to fight, but he just seemed to be struggling a lot in this one.
Well, plus, remember, Neer was coming up to 155, and McGee was coming down from 185. And I think Neer is 29 going on 52, you know, so.
That's a good point. And, of course, one of the guys that came over from Strikeforce, Robbie Lawler. Actually, he was a UFC veteran before Strikeforce. But he ended up making over $100,000, including a $10,000 win bonus. He made $105,000 total. Against Josh Koscheck, $78,000 for getting knocked out. Not too bad for a few minutes of work there. I don't even think it was 2 minutes. I forget the exact time of the knockout, but actually this was the only knockout of the night, believe it or not. So I guess props to Joe Silva for matching these guys up well, because there wasn't any blowouts here.
Yeah, I'm hearing a few rumors about Koscheck possibly getting cut.
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, he's one of those people with some bad history, some controversial issues in the past. So we'll see, but he is one of those big names too. He's been around for a very long time, so it's highly doubtful. I mean, popularity-wise, it would be tough to do that to him. But he has had some struggles. The only thing you can say for him is that most of those recent struggles are against very high-caliber fighters. So I don't foresee it happening. But you know, one more bad fight, he could definitely be on the block. Then we have Brandon Schaub, another guy that was talked about being cut if he didn't do well. And he didn't really show, you know, his best skills. He was kind of, well, really sloppy in a lot of the rounds. But he got a decision there against LeVar Johnson. Actually, he got the knockout, I think.
No, it was a decision.
Because
you remember, he did most of it on the ground. He didn't really want to stand and engage with Johnson, which was good strategy, for sure. Exciting fights, but he did what he had to do.
This was actually one of the closest margins of pay from between the winner and the loser. Brendan got $36,000 for the win with an $18,000 win bonus, and LeVar Johnson got $29,000 in the losing effort there. So pretty close there for the winner and loser.
So I think we could say that was a bit of a pay cut from Schwab's NFL days.
Probably. I wouldn't doubt that. Now, Mike Chiesa, who's fresh off the Ultimate Fighter Live show, he was back in action and looked very competent there and taking out Anton Kuvanen. Kuvanen is not, you know, the type of guy that, you know, has beaten a lot of big names in the past or has shown championship caliber, but it's a good test for Chiesa in his early UFC days here, and he got a $15,000 win bonus and a $15,000 payday, base pay, to give him a $30,000 day. I think he got a rear naked choke submission,
Right.
I don't have the results.
And I would say a few more wins like that, and he's going to be right in the mix.
Yeah, he looked very competent. He didn't look like he was ever in any trouble. And Kuvanen actually walked away with $8,000. So it's one of those guys that I can't even imagine how he was able to afford his training camp for that kind of money. But it is what it is. That's the low on the totem pole pay, I guess. Then we had the other Ultimate Fighter guy. I think he's from the same season, Dennis Bermudez, or the season after. He ended up with $20,000 for what I thought was the fight of the night.
Oh, yeah.
With Matt Grace. Talk about Rock 'em Sock'em Robots.
He's up, he's down, he's up, he's down, he's up, he's down.
It was like both guys were on the verge of getting knocked out at certain points. And Grice, I think, was the closest to getting his bell rung and being in the canvas. But he just kept zombie fighting and coming back from the brink. And just an incredible effort right to the final bell. And both guys really did a great job. I'm pretty sure Dana White probably approved a big-time locker room bonus for those two.
Oh, and well deserved. I mean, that's the kind of fight I hated to see anyone lose. And I'm not arguing with the decision. I mean, I think it was one up going into the third, and Dennis did a little more, so I can't complain about it. But I just hate to see either one lose. That was just such an effort. And the old cliche, you cannot teach heart the way those guys showed it. You just can't teach that. So I hope they'll both be back.
Also, Matt Grice is one of those low on the totem pole guys, I guess, based on his pay. He only got $8,000 for that performance. And although he'll probably fight for a higher amount next time, I think that's a disgrace.
At least they've raised the minimum wage, though, because I know as of 3 years ago, it was $6,000 to show and $6,000 to win. That was minimum wage. So it's up to $8,000 now, so... Inflation strikes.
Well, not necessarily. We haven't got to the last fight. The last fight on this card, actually, which was the first fight on the whole card, as far as, you know, untelevised ones. Nashawn Burrell won the fight. He got a $7,000 win bonus, and he got paid $12,500 total. So that's $5,500 base pay. And then his opponent, Jiří Vilafort, got $6,550. So it looks like the minimum wage is... Depends on what level of record I think you have when you come into the UFC is what you get paid, because I've seen guys get paid as low as $3,000 or $4,000 recently too. They've got a couple other fights. Sam Stout probably for the preliminary fighters had the highest payday. He got $52,000 total for beating Carlos Fedor, who got paid $15,000, and that Stout pay got boosted by a $26,000 win bonus. So he got paid a bonus for his win as much as he got paid for the fight. Not bad. So he has a good contract, obviously, but he's been around a while. He's a big name. So that explains a lot. And he looks great. He looks like he's ready to make another run at a title shot.
I agree. And
then we had Kenny Robertson. He got, like Stout, he only got $16,000, but he got as much for the win bonus as he did for the purse. So 8-8, and he defeated Brock Jardine, who got $8,000 for his base pay. And the same goes for the next fight. Neil Magny got $16,000, $8,000 win bonus, and his opponent, John Manley, who lost the fight, got $8,000. So there you have it. That's UFC 157. And the next one's not for a while, right? I'll have Sure Dogans.
Well, we have, I think there's a fuel card Saturday from Japan with... Right, with Vanderlei Silva and Brian Stann.
Oh, that should be a good one.
Yes, that's kind of... Let's flip a coin here. I mean, which... How much does Silva have left? But, I mean, again, styles make fights, and I don't see too many backward steps in this one.
Right. Well, we've been hogging this broadcast with MMA stuff. I don't know. I'm sure Tony has some boxing news for us.
Well, I do. We had some pretty good fights last week. Got to sit back because, you know, obviously I wasn't going out Saturday night. Got an early fight Sunday. So I got to sit in and first watch the C.K. Smith fight with his win over Canine Bondrage, which we talked about a little bit earlier. For a while, it was a sloppy fight. You get a guy like Canine, and he is so... he's not a fluid fighter. He's almost like a mauler sometimes. And sometimes his fights can be a little difficult to watch. He had two good wins over Corey Spinks, but, you know, sometimes he's so very mechanical. And early, you know, the fight was, you know, it was just happening. You know, it wasn't a whole lot of action. And then Ishii started going more on the defensive. And that was, you know, pretty surprising. And, Canine went on the defensive. And then Ishii became more of the aggressor. And then late rounds, Ishii really started taking it to him, stunned him a few times, won the unanimous decision. It was a split decision? Oh, jeez. I remember they announced him as the winner, but I had the news came on. And you're right, it was two scores of 116-111. And Dave Hess having it 114-13 for Canine. I thought he should have won that fight pretty clearly. Along the line, 116-111 scorecard. Also, Saturday night, they had fights in Atlantic City. A friend of mine missed on the card. Let's pull it up here, and I'll quickly recap. In the main event, Patrick Mahuski won a unanimous 10-round decision over Jamal the Truth Davis. One looks like, you know, pretty much 9 rounds on all the cards. So he was pretty successful there. He's now 21-1 with 13 knockouts. Davis falls to 14-9. And then a friend of mine, Chuck Masaccio, lost. I obviously did not see the fight. But I did talk to my friend Larry Trinandi, who was down there for the card. He had sent some photos. And he said what was really unusual was that the first round was timed at 4 minutes and 30 seconds. So either the timekeeper missed something or something happened. But he said Chuck really looked fatigued in the first round. And, he looked really sluggish. And then in the second round, he got caught with a combination, and he went down. And Larry thought he could have gone up around the count of 6. And they said he barely beat the count at 9. Got hit with a few more shots, and he went back to the corner. And he said he was feeling real nauseous, and he was feeling, real almost lightheaded. So they stopped the fight, and they took him to the hospital for precautions. I'm happy to report that Chuck did update his Facebook page the next day. He praised his victor, Lionel Thompson, who's now 13-2. And he just said, you know, no excuses. He wanted it more. Wasn't my night. So he took a pretty classy approach on that one. But here's what worries me about Chucky. I've known Chucky since 1998, and he's been fighting professionally, I'll tell you right now, since 2005. And... being the fact he is 33 years old, he's never been a big puncher, so he's a lot of his fights he's had to go the distance. So I'm not sure what his next step is, if there will be a next step. I saw him a few weeks ago, didn't really have a chance to talk to him much, but I would like to hopefully catch up and maybe give him a phone call, talk to him, and just to see what he's gonna, try to do with his career. He's a good guy, and we wish him the best. Also, one of Chuck's conquerors, Philadelphia fighter by the name of Garrett Wilson, and I was talking about him last week. You know, he went over to Romania to fight in the IBF title eliminator cruiserweight. Garrett was a fighter. He took a lot of fights early in his career, and he's short, stocky guys. It really took him a long time to really master how to fight taller fighters and get inside. He fought a guy by the name of Alexander Alasky, who was 23-2. And Alasky, and as Garrett said, legitimately won. No excuses there. Alasky won a unanimous 12-round decision, two scores of 116-112, one score of 117-111. But as I said, as Garrett said, you know, he went over there, he gave it his all, and the guy was just a better boxer that night. And, you know, sometimes it happens. So, and I'm also just want to look, and then Friday night, the big fight on on ESPN was a very impressive performance by Lamont Peterson. Overcame a relatively slow start to chop down Kendall Holt. You know, Peterson, the first few rounds looked as rusty as we expected.
How about Holt's left hand in those first couple rounds, Tony? That was an educated left hand. I mean, I was so impressed with that. He was.
Holt was a very good boxer. Very good boxer. Always had a good jab. Always had quick hands. His always downfall was sometimes he would get caught in a slugfest and didn't always possess the greatest chin. But he was boxing well, and he was keeping Peterson off balance. But once Peterson broke through, it became a one-sided fight. And, you know, he took Holt out pretty impressively, and won the IBF welterweight title in the process and set up a fight tentatively scheduled for May 18th with Lucas Matisse. So, and that's going to be in D.C., Peterson's hometown. So that ought to be a pretty interesting fight right there. So we'll see how that turns out. And then there was a showbox card, but by that time, Mr. Sandman had already taken over on me, so I really didn't see much of that. but overall, it was a good weekend for some pretty good fights out there. And you know, from what I heard about the showbox card, you know, it wasn't a very scintillating card. I really didn't miss much. I had some friends that emailed me the next day saying, "Man, good move to fall asleep." But hey, it's always good when you have some good boxing on the horizon. Want to see if we have anything? This weekend I'll briefly touch on. So while I'm looking at BoxRec, do you guys know of anything going on this weekend?
Well, I can cover a little bit of a story from overseas. You might have heard about this one. Herbie Hyde allegedly offered to help throw a world title fight for £1 million. And talk about some investigative reporting. I think we need some of this kind of reporting in the MMA circuits over here to find out why the UFC's got to cut all these guys. But I guess one of the newspapers over there, The Sun, they did got some video footage of Hyde apparently boasting about being able to fix boxing bouts. And they alleged that Hyde offered to arrange for cocaine to be bought as well for the reporter who were posing as, I guess, corrupt businessmen. Basically, Hyde reportedly said, "Whoever, whatever you want, as long as you put up the money." Hold on. I can't seem to get this article to page down correctly. So, basically, he said money talks and bullshit walks. But whoever, which round you want, he said, whatever you want, as long as you put the money. I can guarantee one thing. You can get whoever is the favorite, you can get them to step down for £1 million. You need a big name on a good record. Yeah, like myself. The twice-crowned champion talked about pulling another unwitting top boxer into this game. He described boxing as not about who is best, but instead called it a business. And the 41-year-old British heavyweight also arranged for cocaine to be delivered to undercover reporters for £100 a gram. The cocaine dealer claimed that Hyde gave out the number of the reporters posing as businessmen who were interested in organizing exhibition bouts in the Middle East to arrange a deal. Police confirmed that they're investigating the drug allegations. And I suppose because he didn't actually take the fall, they're not investigating the offers to take one. But Hyde, who's nicknamed the Dancing Destroyer, reportedly lives in a 1.5 million pound home in Norwich, which was actually the scene of a tragedy last year when a 25-year-old was stabbed to death at the party, a party at the house that Hyde was not in attendance at. And the gentleman was knifed up to 3 times in the chest when fighting broke out at the mansion. And they call it a 1.5 million pound mansion, but interestingly enough, in the comments of the story, somebody mentions, I live in that neighborhood and nothing in that neighborhood is valued over $300,000 or something. So they think that the paper exaggerated the value of the house. But actually trying to persuade the reporters to bankroll his comeback at this time. What were you going to say, Tony?
Whenever I hear the name Herbie Hyde, the one thing that always reminds me of is when he, and I believe he was undefeated at the time, he had just won a big fight with Michael Bent, who had knocked out Tommy Morrison in a fluke upset, and then Hyde knocks Bent out and gets a fight with Riddick Bell. And this was after, Bell had already won the title from Evander Holyfield and lost it back. It was around 1995, before the Bo Gulata fights. And they fought on, ESPN or HBO, or probably HBO. And I remember, Bo didn't look his best. He looked a little overweight, but still pretty much dominated Hyde and knocked him down 7 times and scored the knockout. And they went to the post-fight interview, and Hyde was babbling so bad, I wasn't impressed. He goes, I don't think he's that good. They're like, he just knocked you down 7 times. He goes, well, if you think he's the best heavyweight in the world, then I'm obviously number one. I'll never forget that interview. And he looked head in the face, he had a big gap tooth grin, and he was dead serious when he said that. If you think he's the best, then I'm number one. And it's like, I remember reading in like my Ring magazine, because they would always kind of make fun of George Foreman, who would always say some outlandish shit. And like, any guest that probably didn't, George probably understood exactly what he meant.
Well, I stepped down to cruiserweight after his heavyweight success, and he won 14 successive fights and is still unbeaten at that weight. But there is no suggestion that any of his previous fights have been rigged. So it's only the drug stuff that he's going to get into legal trouble for. And I guess this story is probably going to make it impossible for him to get a future fight. I doubt anybody's going to want to work with him after that.
I can't believe he's still fighting. I mean, you figure that Riddick Bell fight had to be about a good 18 years ago.
So, I do have one other UK boxing story if we have time for it, but if you want to run through what's coming up, go ahead and take care of that now.
Go right ahead.
Do you want me to do this one? All right.
Yeah, sure.
British heavyweight star David Price suffered the first defeat of his career in a shock second round defeat by Tony Thompson in Liverpool. And on top of that, his promoter, Frank Maloney, was rushed to the hospital after the fight. Once he saw what the outcome was. Price was considered Britain's best heavyweight prospect since Lennox Lewis, but he was caught by a fairly innocuous-looking shot to the temple and went down. The punch from the American caught the hometown boxer around the back of his left ear, perforating his eardrum. Price got to his feet but was clearly struggling to keep his balance. The referee had no option but to declare Thompson the winner. According to the Telegraph, Price's promoter, Maloney, sunk to his knees after the card at the Echo Arena and had to be taken to hospital. Price had got off to a solid start, using his height and reach advantage to control the opening round, but Thompson went all out from the start of the second round and soon had Price on the ropes before sending him to the canvas. I've been doing that to people since I turned professional and philosophical. Look, philosophical Price said after tasting defeat for the first time as a pro. It's heavyweight boxing. Nobody's invincible. I'll come back from. I didn't take a beating out there tonight. It was one of those shots that caught my ear and my balance had gone. Sometimes it's best to come back as quickly as possible.
I had seen the reports like on Facebook. I saw people reporting, hey, Shocker over in England, Tony Thompson knocked out David Price in 2 rounds. I was like, oh, shit. And then a few minutes later, somebody posted the highlights. So I saw the knockout, and you're right. It was a very innocuous-looking punch. It almost looked it was an open palm slap. And it caught him right on the ear, and it was like right on the ear, almost to the side of the neck. And his legs looked like almost somebody took him out. Somebody almost swung a baseball bat and just took his legs right out from under him. Because he went down, and like when he got up, I even said the referee had to stop that fight. I mean, he couldn't walk straight. He looked like he had just came out of an Irish pub after doing about 12 shots of whiskey and about 6 pints of Guinness.
Oh, jeez. And this poor promoter. Man, that guy had all his hopes set on this dude. Being a world champion and on the fast track. Probably, I don't know if he had a heart attack. I didn't see any further reports on what his condition was. But, I mean, you're sick to your knees. You have to be going through some crazy emotions in public.
Boy, that is really getting behind your fighter. Woo.
No, that's it. I'm going to look again. I don't think we have anything big coming up on Saturday night, but I'm looking forward to next weekend. A friend of mine, we actually even discussed it. We were talking about, unfortunately, he's got a few money issues right now, but he saw in right out of, Northeast Philadelphia, PA, they were having a bus trip and flight ticket to the Brooklyn, whatever it's called, the arena there, to the Hopkins fight next week. And, not a bad deal. It's been, like, for a lower-level ticket, bus trip and ticket, like, $150.
That's doable.
And for an upper-level ticket, $100. So you figure, I mean, my house to Bentown, PA, is about 35 minutes. We would jump in my car, jump right on, I'm right at the turnpike, jump on the turnpike, 45 minutes. I wouldn't want to park my car there because you have not the best area, Franklin Mills Mall. But you would, I'd probably park at my one friend's house and have him drive me over.
Nice.
Maybe even have him pick me up or get a cab back. But I wouldn't mind doing it, but I don't know if I'll have to look into it, see if they're still having it. I mean, that would be cool. If not, what's most likely what I'm going to do is just have some friends over for the flight. Maybe get a couple pizza pies, a couple cases of beer, and the guys that are watching the fights.
Well, another thing I wanted to mention quickly, I don't know if you guys were able to watch it, but I caught the Robot Combat League.
Yes, what a turnaround.
That
a
was
turnaround
not too
in
bad.
The second round. Yeah.
That was kind of entertaining, that show. I thought it was kind of over the top with all the sparks flying. I think a lot of that was fake, but...
Sure.
The robots are faster than I thought they would be.
Yeah, and it seems like there was a human element of a bit of skill there and a bit of strategy.
Right, and Freddie Roach is on the show, too. I don't know if you knew that, Tony.
I did not.
Freddie Roach trained some of these guys on how to throw punches at some point in the show. So there's definitely some actual fighting training involved. And the robots, they don't all look, like they're... super fighters or whatever, but and they don't look like quite like the technology in Real Steel, but they definitely are pretty serious machines.
Yep, and each one has a different style, so that makes it kind of intriguing.
Yeah, and they bleed, even though it's only hydraulic fluid. All right, folks, we're out of here. Till next week.
All
thanks
right,
for stopping by.
Week,
okay, let's go. Let's enjoy Bellator coming right up.